This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
This is the reading of the Wall Street Journal for Monday, May 20th, 2024. I'm Kim Sheridan. Articles read today are primarily from the front page, with additional articles coming from the U.S. News section of the newspaper. Market values from last week are as follows. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed at 40,003.59, up 490.75, or 1.2%. NASDAQ closed at 16,685.97, up 2.1%. Stocks 600 closed at 522.94, up 0.4%. The 10-year Treasury was up 21/32nds with a yield of 4.419%. The price of oil was $80.06 a barrel, up $1.80. The value of the euro, $1.0871, and the yen, 155.68. We begin with this front page article entitled, China Poses Espionage Threat to Undersea Cables, U.S. Fears, by Dustin Valls, Drew Fitzgerald, Peter Ciampelli, and Emma Brown. From Washington, U.S. officials are privately delivering an unusual warning to telecommunications companies. Undersea cables that ferry internet traffic across the Pacific Ocean could be vulnerable to tampering by Chinese repair ships. State Department officials said a state-controlled Chinese company that helps repair international cables, SB Submarine Systems, appeared to be hiding its vessels' locations from radio and satellite tracking services, which the officials and others said defied easy explanation. The warnings highlight an overlooked security risk to undersea fiber optic cables, these officials said. Silicon Valley giants such as Alphabet's Google and Meta Platforms partially own many cables and are investing in more, but they rely on specialized construction and repair companies, including some with foreign ownership, that U.S. officials fear could endanger the security of commercial and military data. The Biden administration's focus on the repair ships is part of a wide-ranging effort to address China's maritime activities in the Western Pacific. Beijing has taken steps in recent decades to counter U.S. military power in the region, often by seeking ways to stymie the Pentagon's communications and other technological advantages in case of a clash over Taiwan or another flashpoint, officials said. U.S. officials have told companies, including Google and Meta, about their concerns that Chinese companies could threaten the security of U.S.-owned cables, a person familiar with the briefing said. In some cases, the conversations have included discussion of Shanghai-based SB Submarine Systems, the person said. Senior Biden administration officials have also received briefings in recent months about the risks posed by Chinese companies, including SBSS, working on repairs to undersea cables, the person said. The security of undersea cables is rooted in the ability of trusted entities to build, maintain, and repair them in a transparent and safe manner, the National Security Council said, noting that satellite ship tracking is one such measure that supports vessel monitoring and safety. The administration declined to comment on SBSS. Google and Meta declined to comment about the Biden administration's concerns related to SBSS. SBSS didn't respond to requests for comment. The gaps in the company's ship location data could be explained by spotty satellite coverage rather than as an effort to hide their positions, another person who is familiar with the company said. The cable owners often have representatives aboard repair ships at sea, which would make any potential meddling with cable gear hard to hide, the person added. The vessels, named the Fu Hai, Fu Tai, and Bold Maverick, periodically disappeared from satellite ship tracking services while operating off Taiwan, Indonesia, and other coastal locations in Asia, according to a Wall Street Journal analysis of shipping data. The data gaps were unusual for commercial cable ships and lacked clear explanation, the officials and industry experts said. Hundreds of thousands of miles of underwater fiber optic cables carry almost all the world's international internet traffic. Dozens of lines lace the Pacific Ocean floor, shuttling data among the Americas, Asia, and many island chains. SBSS is part of a regional consortium of companies that provides ships to fix undersea cables, including some belonging to major U.S. companies, by winching them to the surface, resplicing broken fibers that carry internet data, and returning the lines to the seafloor. U.S. and congressional officials who disclosed their concerns about SBSS wouldn't say whether their worries stemmed from classified intelligence about maritime espionage or only potential threats to internet infrastructure. But commercially available satellite tracking data showed numerous gaps while the company's ships were at sea, they said. Underwater cables are vulnerable to tampering when they are brought to the surface for repairs, U.S. officials said. Tapping global data flows is still far easier on land, industry experts said. But at-sea repair could still offer an opportunity to install a device to remotely disable a cable or to study the technology in advanced signal repeaters installed by other companies. U.S. officials said that cable repair ships pose a security threat because they could engage in clandestine tapping of undersea data streams, mapping of the ocean floor to conduct reconnaissance on U.S. military communication links, or theft of valuable intellectual property used in cable equipment. The ships could also lay cables for the Chinese military, they said. Liu Pengyu, a spokesman for the Chinese embassy in Washington, said he wasn't aware of U.S. concerns about SBSS. It is nothing wrong for Chinese companies to carry out normal business in accordance with the law, he said. We firmly oppose the U.S. to generalize the concept of national security and attack and smear Chinese companies. The SBSS vessels' location tracking beacons have been inoperative periodically over the past 5 years, according to radio and satellite data from commercial data provider Marine Traffic that was reviewed by the journal. A gap in transponder data alone isn't necessarily a red flag, a senior U.S. government official said, but it would raise suspicions if it happens repeatedly, especially if they are operating in the vicinity of a cable that might have strategic significance, such as those ferrying military communications, the official said. The U.S. intelligence community has warned for years about the security of undersea cables, noting in a 2017 report that industry consortia that maintain cables might present vulnerabilities and could be susceptible to threats from insiders. Cable integrity has long been a U.S. concern in the event of a direct conflict with China, former intelligence officials said. SBSS was formed in 1995 as a Chinese-British joint venture. State-owned China Telecom has long held 51% of the business and is in the process of buying the remainder from UK-based Global Marine Systems, people familiar with the matter said. A member of the Chinese Communist Party serves on the SBSS management team, according to the company's website. He didn't reply to a written message seeking comment. The U.S. in 2021 stripped China Telecom's licenses, arguing that it was subject to exploitation, influence, and control by the Chinese government. The move didn't affect U.S. companies' ability to use the repair consortium that includes SBSS. Safeguarding underwater cables has been a focus of U.S. national security officials since the Cold War, when fears of Soviet espionage were paramount. In the 1970s, the U.S. secretly placed wiretaps on underwater Soviet lines in an intelligence coup known as Operation Ivy Bells. Beijing's rapid military buildup in the South China Sea in recent decades has heightened U.S. government worries about the cable's vulnerability to disruption or tampering. U.S. officials said they are especially concerned about the security of cables that carry sensitive data to U.S. bases and other military assets in the Pacific and around the globe. Though encrypted, that data can pass through commercial internet lines. To prevent interruptions from damaged lines, the U.S. government is funding Pacific cable projects along with U.S. internet companies, such as Google. Google said this year it was investing $1 billion in new cables and other infrastructure projects in the region. Subcom, a cable ship company owned by private equity giant Cerberus Capital Management, receives $10 million in annual U.S. government payments for participating in the cable security fleet, a program partially overseen by the Pentagon. It requires the ships to be available for critical cable repair or other emergencies. At a congressional hearing in January, Representative Ann Wagner, a Missouri Republican, said she was very concerned about Chinese companies repairing or even having access to undersea cables that are owned by U.S. carriers. Nathaniel Fick, the State Department's top cybersecurity official who was testifying at the hearing, said he shared her concern. "I believe when our adversaries tell us what they intend to do, we should believe them," he said. Fick told the Journal that undersea cable security can't be assured if the lines are built, maintained, or repaired by suppliers who are subordinate to or are beholden to authoritarian governments. SBSS is one of three maintenance ship owners that are members of Yokohama Zone, a consortium used by internet cable owners in the Northwest Pacific. The group keeps ships on standby based in China, South Korea, and Japan. SBSS parent China Telecom hosted a meeting of Yokohama Zone companies in Wuhan, China, in March, according to people familiar with the event. In response to questions about SBSS, Yokohama Zone chairman Masanori Araki, a submarine cable expert from Japanese telecom company and ship owner KDDI, said the Chinese company is in compliance with the consortium's performance standards. "Cable owners are receiving and enjoying assured service quality, whichever service provider they may use," he said. Industry analysts said that shifting responsibility for fixing Asian cables away from Chinese vessels could pose a challenge. Cable owners have few choices among an aging fleet of about 50 ships, said Mike Constable, who runs telecom consulting firm Infra Analytics and previously led China's Huawei Marine Networks, now known as HMN Technologies. "You've got a Chinese asset repairing U.S. invested cables," Constable said. No one had really thought about that before. Our next front page article is entitled, "Helicopter with Iran President Crashes in Heavy Fog," by Lawrence Norman, Benoit Falcone, and Aresu Ekbaldi. A helicopter carrying President Ibrahim Raisi of Iran crashed in the northwestern part of the country, the interior minister said Sunday, and no signs of life were detected when searchers located the crash scene in a mountainous area shrouded in heavy fog. Rescue teams located the aircraft early Monday morning, state television said, without providing any information on the president's condition. Also aboard the helicopter was the foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdul Abdullahian, state television said. State TV said there was no sign of the passengers being alive at the crash site. Thermal detectors that detect the heat of bodies have not sent us any signal. Pir Hossein Kolivand, the head of Iran's Red Crescent, told state TV. If the 63-year-old president is dead or incapacitated, Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei would be deprived of a longtime ally and potential successor as Tehran angles for regional dominance through armed militias that are fighting the U.S. and Israel. Drones, dogs, and search and rescue teams were used to locate the helicopter as fog and bad weather made the work difficult, the Interior Minister Ahmad Vahidi said on state television. Khamenei acknowledged the afternoon accident late Sunday, saying that he hoped God would bring the president and the others back. The nation of Iran should not be worried and anxious. No disruption will occur in the country's affairs, he said, according to state TV. Raisi's deputy, Mohsen Mansouri, vice president for executive affairs, has headed to Tabriz, the largest city in Iran's northwest, which is about 100 miles from where the helicopter appeared to have gone down, state TV reported. Iran's ministers of oil, roads, and power are also in the search area, while the interior minister is in Tabriz directing the search operations, it said. Raisi's security detail and crew members were also flying with him, along with the governor of the East Azerbaijan province and a senior local cleric. In Washington, a National Security Council spokesman said the U.S. is aware of the reports but had no comment on the situation. A spokesman for the State Department said it was closely following reports of what it called a possible hard landing of a helicopter in Iran carrying the Iranian president and foreign minister. The death or incapacitation of Raisi or Amir Abdullahian, age 60, isn't expected to change the country's posture on any of the hot geopolitical issues involving Iran, including concerns about its nuclear program and Israel's war in Gaza. But a government transition amid the current turmoil in the Mideast is an additional challenge for Iran to navigate. The crash comes as the Middle East is in turmoil, with Iran backing armed militias across the region that are attacking Israel and U.S. assets. Last week, senior U.S. and Iranian officials held talks in Oman about regional tensions and Iran's nuclear program, according to people familiar with the meetings. It came after Iran directly attacked Israel for the first time, launching some 300 missiles and drones at the country. Most were intercepted by a U.S. and Israeli coalition. Rescue teams were sent to the vicinity of the crash, which occurred in the mountainous Arasbaran forest in the country's far northwest, near Iran's border with Azerbaijan, according to the Red Crescent Society. The search has become harder given the heavy fog, Iran's health minister said on state TV. Turkey sent two drones to help the rescue effort as poor weather prevented Iran from using its own drones, Iran's state news agency IRNA said. The president has been traveling to Tabriz after Raisi had inaugurated the opening of a dam with Azerbaijan's leader Ilham Aliyev on the country's shared border. Iranian state TV broadcast images of people praying for the president's health. A senior Hamas official released a statement of support for the president. For years, Iran has had to rely on old aircraft and equipment because of Western sanctions on the sale of planes and spare parts to the country. A conservative cleric and for decades a confidant of Khamenei, Raisi became Iran's eighth president in August 2021, leading a significantly harder line government than his predecessor, Hassan Rouhani. There has been speculation that he could be a contender to become the country's supreme leader when Khamenei, who is 85, dies. Iran's relations with the West have soured under Raisi, who was elected with the lowest turnout in years after a raft of other contenders were excluded. His election marked the consolidation of anti-Western hardliners in the Islamic Republic. Raisi has overseen the country's worsening relationship with the West, as well as a harsh crackdown on civil rights at home amid the fiercest protests in decades. Under Raisi, ties with China and Russia have grown much closer through Tehran's Look East strategy, including the supply of weapons to Russia for its war in Ukraine. Raisi has also helped steer Iran toward a more confrontational stance with Israel. Raisi has enjoyed a close relationship with the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which for more than a decade has expanded Iran's military footprint abroad, including by propping up militias near Israel's borders. On the nuclear front, the Biden administration had come close to reaching a deal to revive the 2015 nuclear agreement before Raisi's election, but the new government put talks on hold for months and then returned to the negotiating table with new demands. Talks collapsed in 2022, ending for now the possibility of broad Western sanctions relief for Iran in exchange for tight but temporary restrictions on Iran's nuclear work. While Khamenei has the final word on decisions over nuclear policy, Iran's nuclear work has advanced significantly since Raisi took office. Iran has now produced enough fissile material for around 3 nuclear weapons, experts said. Iran denies working on nuclear weapons, and U.S. officials said there is no current evidence that they are trying to build a weapon. If Raisi were to have died or otherwise become incapacitated, fresh elections would need to be held within 50 days under Iran's constitution. It is expected that the vacancy would be filled in the interim by Mohammad Mokhber, Iran's first vice president and the former head of a $95 billion foundation nominally controlled by the supreme leader. As for Iran's policies on the global stage, including the nuclear issue and the war in Gaza, few analysts expect dramatic changes. "I don't think this will have a major impact on Iran's approach to the major issues," said Ali Vaez, Iran project director at Conflict Resolution Organization Crisis Group, though he added that it would deprive Iran's supreme leader of a trusted lieutenant. Raisi would have been a good choice because he was a subservient president who had done the leadership's bidding for decades, Vaez said. Raisi is known for his role in a 1988 commission that condemned thousands of political prisoners to death. Later, as judiciary chief, he presided over the mass imprisonment of journalists, political activists, and dual citizens, including Iranian Americans. Earlier in the day on Sunday, Azerbaijan's state news agency had reported on the two leaders meeting at the border between the two neighbors near the Azerbaijani city of Jabrayil. The state news agency quoted Raisi and Aliyev exchanging veiled criticisms of the U.S. "Some may not like our meetings and our joint successes," Raisi said. The agency quoted Aliyev echoing that sentiment, saying, "The joint success of our people makes our friends happy, and those who don't like it, I think it would be better if they minded their own business." Next on the front page is this article entitled, "Fed Softens Rule Plans Amid Fight with Bank Executives," by Andrew Ackerman. From Washington, J.P. Morgan Chase's Jamie Dimon and other big bank CEOs played hardball with the Federal Reserve over proposals that the lenders hold more capital. Now it looks like those tactics are paying off. The Fed and two other federal regulators are moving toward a plan that would significantly lessen a nearly 20% mandated increase in capital for the biggest U.S. banks, according to people familiar with the matter. Required increases in capital for banks like J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs, meant to ensure they have sufficient buffers to absorb potential losses, would on average be about half as much as originally floated. It would be a big win for the banks and Diamond. Banks have said the rules as originally proposed would drive up costs and crimp lending. It also represents a shift in the balance of power between big banks and their regulators, turning the page on an era in which the Fed held the upper hand. Diamond, at a meeting in Washington last fall, told his fellow CEOs to bypass Michael Barr, the central bank's vice chair for banking supervision and the main architect of the original plan. Diamond urged his fellow bankers to instead press other Fed governors, in particular Chair Jerome Powell, to alter the proposed capital rules. By doing so, the bankers hope to capitalize on internal disagreement and concern on the seven-member Fed board over the regulatory proposals. Diamond has characterized Barr's proposal as flawed and poorly calibrated, and publicly pushed for other Fed governors to speak out. What person in what ivory tower thinks that that is a rational thing to do? Diamond said at a conference last September. I'd like to know what the other governors think. He also expressed frustration with regulators in general, saying in his annual shareholder letter that banks' relationships with them have deteriorated and are increasingly less constructive. Big U.S. bank CEOs met with Powell more than a dozen times between last July and March, according to the central banker's public calendar. Those included four meetings or calls with Diamond. On Friday, the Fed released calendars for Barr showing he met 15 times with the CEOs of the largest U.S. banks during the same period. He also met with Diamond in April and in May, a Fed spokesman said. I have not felt bereft of attention from the banking lobby, Barr said in a statement. Top officials from all three agencies involved in the pending capital rules, the Fed, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, are still negotiating substantive and technical revisions, and there is no guarantee that a deal will come together. It also could be late this year before any plan is ready. The pending rules are the last in a series of steps global regulators agreed to in the wake of the 2008-2009 financial crisis, which are aimed at boosting the resilience of the banking system and guarding against taxpayer-backed bailouts. The latest proposal also seeks to protect against a variety of other risks, including the potential to lose money from cyber attacks. Its July release kicked off the biggest regulatory fight in at least a decade, featuring fierce lobbying from big banks as well as pushback from a bipartisan chorus of lawmakers and others, including affordable housing advocates. Unlike other fights over financial regulation, the campaign involved a series of pricey television ads during National Football League games warning of dire economic consequences. Goldman Sachs spent millions of dollars on its own advocacy campaign. The Financial Services Forum, which represents the eight largest U.S. banks, also asked its members to chip in $2 million apiece on another ad campaign. Among those leading the charge was Diamond, who urged bank executives to bypass Barr during a fall board meeting of the Bank Policy Institute, a Washington lobbying group. In addition to Powell, banks have also viewed Philip Jefferson, the Fed's vice chair, as a key swing vote. Barr is still in charge of shepherding the plan day to day, but is now closely coordinating with Powell, who is playing a more active role. In March, Powell said that the new rules won't be finalized without broad and material changes. He also said any plan would have broad support on the board and opened the door to scrapping the existing plan and starting over again with a fresh proposal. The FDIC and OCC are resistant to starting over. Even if the agencies eventually reach an agreement to finalize the rules this year, the banks could still challenge them in court. One recent wrinkle in the negotiations revolved around the way banks account for the value of their trading positions and other capital markets activities. The issue is likely to have an outsized effect on five of the largest Wall Street firms, which, besides Goldman and J.P. Morgan, include Morgan Stanley, Bank of America, and Citigroup. Powell and other Fed officials support reducing the amount of capital reserves tied to such activities relative to the proposed rule. The issue accounts for a significant amount of the overall increase in capital envisioned for the largest banks. Officials at the two other agencies involved in drafting the rules were resistant to watering down market risk provisions, worried it would undermine a pillar of the new framework. If the FDIC and OCC persuaded the Fed to leave the provisions largely untouched from the proposal, Fed officials have indicated they want to compensate with cuts elsewhere in the plan. Also found on the front page is an article entitled, "Want Stock in SpaceX? You Need a Connection," by Micah Maidenberg. SpaceX has become one of the investing world's most exclusive clubs. Invites circulate via group chats, word of mouth, and emails marked confidential. Investment vehicles providing access to Elon Musk's closely held rocket and satellite company have generated hefty demand and fees for those arranging them. For years, the company's value has only gone in one direction, up. Hawthorne, California-based SpaceX, which flirted with bankruptcy not long after Musk founded the company more than two decades ago, now dominates the launch business. And it has built its satellite internet division, Starlink, into an industry and geopolitical force. Current and former employees, venture capitalists, and creators of SpaceX investing vehicles have all benefited from the intense investor appetite for the company. Gaining access to SpaceX shares can mean sizable costs. SpaceX also carefully tracks its investor base, and not everyone gets in. As a private company, SpaceX isn't required to report financial results. The Wall Street Journal reported last year that the company in 2022 doubled its revenue compared with the previous year's total as Starlink gained customers and global attention for its role in Ukraine. Many investors are betting that growth will continue for years to come. You can argue about where it's trading in terms of valuation, whether that's the right place to buy, but there's a whole lot of believers in this stock, said Glenn Anderson, chief executive of Rainmaker Securities, which operates a marketplace where investors can trade investment interest in private companies such as SpaceX. Investor demand has been a factor in SpaceX's steadily climbing valuation over the past decade, providing executives and other staff the chance to cash out company stock at ever higher prices. That is a benefit akin to programs used by publicly traded companies to attract talent. It has also enabled SpaceX's longer-term investors to mark up the value of their stakes, bolstering their portfolio's performance. SpaceX has raised $9 billion in primary funding over time, and investors who have participated directly in the company's traditional funding rounds include blue-chip firms such as Fidelity and Alphabet's Google. SpaceX hasn't raised money for itself in a couple of years, a sign of its improving financial performance and strong cash position. For many other investors, fresh batches of shares now often come from former and current SpaceX employees who have the opportunity to sell during so-called liquidity events the company sets up. Securing access isn't easy. Opportunities can bubble up informally through phone calls or via online lists that don't circulate widely, people familiar with the deal said. Shares of SpaceX were valued at $97 each during the most recent employee stock sale, implying a $180 billion valuation for the company, according to people familiar with the matter. That was up from a $12 billion valuation in 2015. Some of the strongest demand comes from wealthier people who meet financial requirements to purchase slices of special investment companies set up to hold SpaceX stock. Investors can also purchase interests in vehicles that own shares in those special investment companies, a nesting doll effect. Musk, SpaceX's chief executive, has grappled with challenges involved in operating Tesla, the one public company he leads. At the electric car maker, he has battled securities regulators and faced government probes. In January, Musk lost a shareholder lawsuit over his pay package. Last year, he recommended that companies go public only if they absolutely need to. Musk is both a draw and a risk for investors at SpaceX, according to investors and documents viewed by the journal. A recent investment offering for SpaceX listed Musk as a factor they should account for. Mr. Musk has become an increasingly public personality and makes public statements regularly, with many of those statements causing controversy, a document viewed by the journal shows. Musk and a SpaceX spokesman didn't respond to requests for comment. I think investors in SpaceX know exactly what they are doing, and they are lucky to be investors in SpaceX, said Tim Draper, a longtime venture investor and an early backer of SpaceX. Hank Medina, an investor behind Litquidity, who has been dubbed the meme lord of Wall Street, said in an interview that the syndicate sold about $2 million worth of exposure to SpaceX, or double its original allocation. The minimum check size to get in, $50,000. In December, Litquidity Syndicate, an investment group that usually focuses on early-stage companies, emailed a list of investors saying they had the chance to get access to SpaceX by purchasing interests in a special investment vehicle. That vehicle would be exposed to SpaceX shares through another investment vehicle, according to the email, a copy of which was viewed by the journal. Investors who bought access would pay a 4% management fee for the first year, split between two other firms involved in the deal. Litquidity itself would get 5% of potential future profits, with another partner taking 20%, according to the email. Medina said the fees partly reflected pent-up demand for SpaceX and investor conviction in the company. I wouldn't have done this if I didn't think there wasn't more room to run, Medina said. Demand for SpaceX-linked investments is part of how the rocket launcher ensures there are buyers for current and former employees looking to sell holdings. Still, SpaceX has worked to keep a tight grip on who ultimately owns its stock. A Hong Kong subsidiary of Leo Group, a China-based company with businesses such as pump manufacturing and digital marketing, in 2021 said it contributed $50 million into a vehicle that would invest in SpaceX, according to securities and legal filings. Shortly after Leo disclosed the investment in a securities filing in China, the investment vehicle's managers moved to cancel the deal, according to a lawsuit the subsidiary filed in the U.S. They sought to disqualify Leo's subsidiary because SpaceX's chief financial officer was unhappy with media coverage of Leo Group's disclosure of its investment in SpaceX, the lawsuit alleged. The suit is pending in Delaware State Court. Aaron Marks, a lawyer at Kirkland & Ellis, representing the defendants, who have contended in court their actions were appropriate, declined to comment. Leo Group couldn't be reached. Andrew Stern, a lawyer at Sydney Austin, representing the Leo subsidiary, subsidiary declined to comment. SpaceX documents viewed by the journal unrelated to the case say employees can't transfer shares to other holders without company and board approval. Transfers to potential competitors, non-U.S. holders, or entities the company considers unfriendly are unlikely to ever be permitted, according to the documents, which relate to a stock purchase program. SpaceX also says in the documents that it doesn't plan to approve transfers of employee stock arranged through any public posting, message board, trading portal, internet site, or similar manner. The company has another reason for keeping close tabs on its shareholder base, U.S. securities law. Private companies are typically required to make periodic disclosures of their financial performance once they hit certain milestones, such as having more than $10 million in assets and 2,000 official owners. Those thresholds generally exclude so-called beneficial holders, or those who have an indirect interest in the company's shares. The regulatory limits are the reason SpaceX cannot offer stock to anyone who wants to buy it, Musk said on X last year. SpaceX executives have spoken publicly about potentially spinning off Starlink as a public company, but they have also voiced confidence in their ability to continue cashing out staffers seeking money for their shares. I think the reason to take any company public is to give employees liquidity, SpaceX President Gwynne Shotwell said at a conference in early 2023. But at SpaceX, we have been able to give employees liquidity. This front page article is entitled Church Startups Spread Franchise Model Across U.S. by Francis X. Roca, Ariane Campo Flores, and Adolfo Flores. Aaron Burke launched Radiant Church a decade ago in a rundown movie theater in Tampa, Florida, offering a model of Christianity increasingly popular among America's faithful. The church leans conservative on matters of gender and sexuality, and its services feature a Pentecostal-style exuberance with high-energy bands and entertaining sermons. Radiant drew fewer than 200 guests in the early days. It now averages nearly 8,000 in 9 church locations. Burke, a pastor ordained in the Pentecostal Assemblies of God, started his church with more than faith. He sold a thrift store in Pensacola, Florida, and raised other funds, including $30,000 from the Association of Related Churches, a franchise-style church network known as ARC. ARC functions as a startup accelerator, providing money and mentoring in exchange for a continuing cut of church revenues that it invests in opening new churches. Similar entrepreneurial networks are sprouting new, largely non-denominational places of worship at a time when many traditional church congregations are shrinking. The new churches are opening across the U.S. from urban centers to suburbs, red states and blue, as well as abroad. The church planting networks, established as nonprofit organizations, deploy marketing, branding, and social media strategies akin to other franchise businesses. We need pastors that know how to lead in the church with marketplace principles, said Burke, 40 years old, who has an MBA and a doctorate in ministry. In addition to operating the thrift store, he also has bought and sold used vehicles. ARC has started 1,114 churches in the U.S. and abroad since 2001, including 40 last year. Average attendance on launch day was about 500 people in the first quarter this year, the organization said. Another church startup network, Acts 29, currently has 644 churches, mostly in the U.S., as well as in Italy, Mexico, and Thailand. Officials at the church startup networks say traditional Christian evangelism could use a boost. Church planting is pioneering something new, for the sake of communicating these unchanging truths of the good news of Jesus, said Adam Flint, vice president of church planting at Acts 29. Catholic, evangelical, and mainline Protestant churches in the U.S. are losing membership, in part because more young people shun religious affiliation, studies show. 2 decades ago, 42% of American adults attended religious services every week, or nearly every week, Gallup polling found. Now it is 30%. As a result, thousands of churches close each year. The networks take a fresh approach. It's almost like a Silicon Valley venture capitalist model of church growth, said Ryan Burge, an associate professor at Eastern Illinois University, who specializes in religion and politics. New here? Burke and his wife, Katie Burke, rented a dingy movie theater in a strip mall in 2013 and went to work. They scrubbed carpets and cleaned bathrooms. Volunteers decorated spaces for a cafe and a spot to care for children. They bought a sound system, video equipment, and lighting. Burke set out to attract the devout and newcomer alike to Radiant Church. He set up parking lot greeters and gave concise sermons, punctuated with humor and applicable to the workday life. "We're going to do everything possible to not make it difficult for people who are turning to God," he said. On a recent Sunday morning, congregants streamed into the church, passing bright orange signs at the entrance that read, "New here? Swing by and say hi." Many people were in their 20s and 30s and accompanied by children. A live band and singers kicked off the service. People in the audience swayed to the rhythm and held up their arms. Burke's sermon focused on the perils of selfishness. He quoted the Bible and illustrated its messages with lighthearted stories about fad diets and the selfie culture. At one point, aides brought two ladders on stage, one labeled self and the other sacrifice. He strained theatrically to climb both at the same time, his legs growing farther apart as he got higher, to the point of nearly toppling. "You can only go so far trying to live between the two," he said to laughter. After the sermon, Burke headed to his office with staff members and volunteers to critique the service. They discussed awkward musical transitions, adjustments to camera shots for the online audience, and possible tweaks to the sermon. One woman suggested Burke exaggerate the ladder scene by climbing even higher. "It almost has to be, oh gosh, he's going to fall," she said. "I don't want to go viral," Burke replied jokingly. Burke's sermons are delivered to 4 services each Sunday at the Tampa Movie Theater. They also are streamed online and broadcast live to the 8 locations in the area where Burke is projected on a giant screen. Those satellite locations, some in rented spaces at schools, have their own bands and worship programs. Radiant took in nearly $18 million last year in tithes and special offerings. It paid $248,000 to ARC and individual church startups. Radiant spent $3.4 million for its expansion, $6.2 million on operations, and $5.7 million for personnel. Tara DeMonche started attending the East St. Petersburg location nearly 2 years ago. She was a lifelong member of an African Methodist Episcopal church and said she wasn't growing spiritually. DeMonche and her husband, Damas DeMonche, said they felt welcome when they visited Radiant. They joined in church activities, including a prayer group. Sermons from Burke and the other ministers resonated with her, breaking down the information and the scripture in a way that applies to your life, said DeMonche, age 48. "That's the one thing that keeps me coming back." Sermon strategies. Churches like Radiant were what ARC's founders had in mind when they formed their organization 23 years ago. Executive Director Dino Rizzo said they started slowly. By 2009, they were launching an average of 50 new churches a year. The network, based in Birmingham, Alabama, invested more than $7 million in opening new churches last year. As religious nonprofits, the networks are exempt from requirements to file annual returns to the Internal Revenue Service. ARC said it had $16.8 million in revenue during 2022, the most recent year it has released figures. $3.1 million went to administrative costs and $13.6 million paid for program expenses, including conferences and training. ARC provides church founders with as much as $100,000 in matching funds as a no-interest loan. The arrangement calls for the church, if it succeeds, to pay a portion of its annual revenue to ARC. About 90% of its new churches are still operating after 5 years, network officials said. Those aspiring to open new churches with network help are generally married couples, according to ARC, which provides training. At a recent two-day session in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida, speakers advised the audience to brace for an arduous challenge. Church planting is not for the faint of heart, said T.J. McCormick, who started Coastal Community Church in Parkland, Florida. ARC's launch strategy is to set a goal of drawing at least 200 people to the first service. One speaker said pastors should strive for a launch team of at least 45 people to perform such tasks as setting up for services and being ushers. Another suggestion, gather prospective congregants to deliver a pitch for the new church over drinks and snacks. A couple discussed search engine optimization, learning to push the name of their new church to the top of Google searches. They suggested buying Google ads and paying for certain keywords and phrases, such as Church for Young Adults Near Me. In a training session about worship services, a speaker advised pastors to use plain language and teach principles people can use in their daily lives. Keep sermons tightly written, the speaker said. TikTok has shortened the attention span of the world. ARC performs background checks on people applying to start a church, scrutinizing finances and checking social media accounts. The process is intense, said Michael Matthew, who founded Houston's Eternal Rock Church in 2020 with his wife, Lisbeth Hernandez Matthew. Their credit scores didn't reach ARC's threshold because of medical debt, he said, and the couple worked with a financial coach to boost them sufficiently. The couple were asked to demonstrate their ability to preach, manage staff, and attract volunteers. They needed a branding and marketing strategy and had to show they could produce a year's worth of sermons. They presented their plan to ARC representatives. It would be almost like a Christian Shark Tank type of atmosphere, said Matthew, age 47. At Acts 29, based in Mission Viejo, California, pastors interested in starting their own churches first submit an inquiry online. The formal application requires sermon samples and theological reflections. Next is a two-day retreat, where applicants are assessed by experienced church founders. Noah Heron and his wife, Maddie Heron, arrived in Nashville, Tennessee, with $2,000 in 2022. They raised $675,000, $100,000 of it from ARC, and much of the rest from other churches, and opened Way Church last year with 551 people attending on the first day. The couple covered all of the church's launch expenses and operational costs for the first year, said Noah Heron, age 29. He tapped his experience starting a social media business. Back then, he said, he focused on promoting products. Now it's a totally different message, Heron said. It's more about community and God. Influencers spread debunked sunscreen link to cancer, by Jennifer Kalfas. A woman tilts her face toward the sun and closes her eyes. Do you wear sunscreen? Reads a caption in the video, which has more than a million views on X. No, the woman responds. A new caption appears. There is no proof the sun causes cancer. The 15-second video is a glimmer of the anti-sunscreen sentiment emanating from some influencers and celebrities. Their claims, debunked by dermatologists and scientists in other videos, range from misconceptions that sunscreen itself causes cancer to conspiracies that sunscreen is a ploy by pharmaceutical companies to pad profits and sicken people. Recalls of some spray sunscreens after a testing company detected contamination of benzene, a chemical that can cause cancer, have also fueled skepticism. We are literally rubbing cancer into our skins, one TikTok user said in a viral video last year. Some wellness influencers tout the sun's natural healing powers. Others tell their followers to make homemade sunscreen or that sun protection prevents people from producing the vitamin D that they need. Consuming seed oils is what really causes sunburns, some say. In fact, sunburn is caused by the sun, dermatologists confirmed. Sensibly using sunscreen is far safer than excessive sun exposure, they said. Broad-spectrum sunscreen protects skin from ultraviolet radiation that can cause sunburn, skin cancer, and signs of aging. Health agencies in the U.S. and elsewhere list sunscreen as crucial in preventing skin cancer. Cosmetic chemist Michelle Wong, who debunks misconceptions about sunscreen under the online handle Lab Muffin Beauty Science, said myth-busting has become a full-time job. In a recent YouTube video, Wong breaks down claims that sunscreen doesn't help prevent skin cancer and that seed oils cause sunburns. The long, obscure names of sunscreen ingredients can help people conclude they are nefarious, Wong said. Sort of like stranger danger, essentially. Maggie Dudek didn't wear sunscreen growing up in Hawaii or while she played tennis for Cal State Los Angeles. The 41-year-old content creator used tanning beds in her 20s. A couple of years ago, a biopsy of a bump on her nose showed basal cell carcinoma. In a 2023 video, Dudek showed images of her surgery and recovery with a clear message. Sunscreen didn't cause her cancer, the sun did. Excessive sun exposure and tanning beds can increase risks for basal cell carcinoma, according to the American Cancer Society. I'm not a doctor, Dudek said, but I can tell you that I know I got skin cancer from not wearing sunscreen. And this is where our time will expire for today. This will conclude the reading of the Wall Street Journal for Monday, May 20th, 2024. I'm Kim Sheridan, wishing you all the best.